So as we approach our passage today, prior passages reveal to us that at some point Jacob was afraid. Jacob is on his journey back from Mesopotamia with his family. He's going back home where God had called him. He's on his way. He's crossing over into Canaan here. And he's fearful, or he was. We're told that in a number of places. He had good reason to fear going back because of Esau. If you remember, 21 years ago or so, he left his home because he was afraid that Esau was going to kill him, because Esau pretty much made that his point. And so Esau had been enraged and intent on killing him, and so Jacob is now approaching the land of Canaan. If you remember, he sent word ahead with his household or his staff to go reach out to Esau and say that he was coming home. And the men reported back to Jacob that, well, Esau's coming and he's got 400 men with him. And the way that Jacob had interpreted that was, likely that Esau was coming to kill him, maybe kill his family. And so he was afraid. If you go back to chapter 32, verse 7 and 8, it says, Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed, and he divided the people who were with him into basically two different groups, flocks and herds, and the camels into two companies. And he said, if Esau comes to the one company and attacks it, then the company which is left will escape. And so it tells us here that Jacob is afraid, even when he prays down in verse 11, deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, that he will come and attack me and the mothers and the children. After he had prayed, he then sends these gifts on to Esau. And you remember how he did it. He took over 550 animals or so, and he sent them in groups, one after another, kind of staggering them onto Esau. And we saw that that may have been an attempt to appease him, maybe to make him look favorably upon him. In fact, he claims as much. But, as I alluded to last week, after that he wrestled with God, and I had proposed this idea that as he actually approached Esau in our passage today, it's not really clear whether or not he is still afraid. He wrestled, and while he already got done wrestling with the Lord, he says, I have seen the face of God, and most of our translations say, yet my life has been delivered. And we saw how a lot of commentators will look at that as basically him saying, I saw God and somehow I'm still alive. But I don't know that that's the best way to understand that. Another translation, and it is seen in a few places, the word yet there can simply be translated as and. So it would read, I have seen God's face and my life has been, or my life will be, delivered. So the question is, was he basically in awe that he was still standing after he wrestled with God and saw God face to face? Or was he basically reflecting on his previous prayer where he prayed that God would deliver him? And he uses that same word here when he says, I've seen God's face and my life has been preserved. And my gut, as I look through the context and other things, I lean towards that idea that what he was saying is, the Lord will protect me. I've seen his face, and he'll protect me. And so he then goes on to see Esau with this renewed or encouraged faith, this faith and trust in the Lord that the Lord had answered his prayer. Can I prove that? No. That's the challenge to us sometimes. But I do find it interesting that prior to wrestling with God, he divided his family into two camps, meaning he would separate them in the hopes that, well, Esau will attack one, but the others will survive. But after wrestling with God, he puts them back together. Verse 22 of chapter 32 says, now he arose that same night and took his two wives and his two maids and his 11 children, and he crossed the ford of the Jabbok. He took them and sent them across the stream, and he sent across whatever he had. They're now back together. Not only that, but as he goes across, we're going to see that he takes and divides them again, but in sort of a, he puts the maidservants with their children. He then puts his wife with their children. But he actually then goes in front of them and leads them to Esau. And in the text that we'll see today, there doesn't appear to be any fear. So I believe that Jacob is now approaching Esau with a renewed faith and trust in the Lord. But again, I can't prove that, but I think the context kind of bears that out. We're going to look at this passage today. I'm going to break it down into five small chunks. I'm going to leave the takeaways for the end, but it's going to break down this way. Jacob actually approaches Esau, and we're going to see that he approaches him with an attitude of humility and respect. We're then going to see how Esau accepts Jacob with grace and affection. Thirdly, we're going to see Jacob shares the Lord's blessings with Esau. Fourth, we're going to see that Jacob and Esau then part in peace, suggesting that the relationship has been mended. And then lastly, we're going to see that both God and Jacob fulfill their promises to one another, and that's where we're going to find our primary takeaway. So let's go ahead and look at the first three verses. Jacob approached Esau with this amazing attitude of humility and respect. Look at verses 1, 2, and 3 from chapter 33. It says, "Then Jacob lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, Esau was coming, and 400 men with him. So he divided the children among Leah and Rachel and the two maids. He put the maids and their children in the front, and Leah and her children next, and Rachel and Joseph last. But he himself passed on ahead of them and bowed down to the ground 7 times until he came near to his brother." It's interesting, I was reading a couple of other, I'll call them smaller commentaries on something was going on here, and they had made all of them had made the comment that Jacob was basically had no courage, that, you know, he was afraid and actually very selfish because he put his wives and his children and all that in front of him, and they made a big deal out of that. And then I read this verse and I went, but wait a minute, here he goes ahead of them. That doesn't seem to match what they were saying. And so we see what he does here is he breaks the families down into their groups, the maidservants with their children, then his wives with their children, and he ultimately goes ahead, it says. It doesn't tell us why he really does that. The general consensus among Bible scholars seems to be that Jacob was trying to protect those who were most dear to him. So he puts those that weren't quite as important to him, the maidservants and their children. And then maybe Esau would attack them, and it would protect Rachel and Leah and his kids. I don't really buy that because, just practically when I think about it, if Esau was intent on killing Jacob and his family, would he stop at the maidservants and their children? Probably not. He'd probably slaughter them all. So I think it's a weak argument to say that what Jacob was doing here was very crafty and that he was willing to sacrifice the maidservants and their children. They just weren't important to him, and he's only going to save Leah and Rachel. I think that's kind of a weak argument. But after separating his family into these groups, Jacob went on ahead of them, it says. And it kind of, again, defies this argument that he was somehow weak or that he somehow didn't care about the wives and children or was trying to protect himself by putting them in front. Because again, it says, verse 3, "But he himself passed on ahead of them and bowed down to the ground 7 times as he came near to his brother." So what we see here is as Jacob approaches Esau, he shows a tremendous amount of humility and respect for Esau. We first see it in his actions because it says here in verse 3 that he bowed down. But it doesn't say that he just bowed down. It says that he bowed down 7 times as he came to his brother. And the indication appears to be not that he sort of stopped and then bowed to the ground 7 times and then went on, but that it was probably he would go a little distance and bow down. He would go a little distance and he would bow down again. He would go a little further and bow down until he finally arrived before Esau, where he would have bowed down probably the last time. So Jacob, I believe, is paying homage and respect. That is typically why in the ancient Near East somebody would bow down in front of somebody else. It was a way to show humility, pay homage, to pay respect. Some want to suggest that this was all theatrics by Jacob, and he was simply trying to appease and manipulate Esau. And so he, you know, bows down, and it's all fake. There's nothing genuine about it. I think there's this tendency, because of what the scriptures have taught us about Esau, to always disparage Esau. There's nothing good about Esau. every action is wicked, or every action is, or I'm sorry, not Esau, Jacob. It's trying to disparage Jacob in some respects because he's a deceiver and he just, you know, he's always got some angle that he's trying to do. And yet we've seen Jacob grow throughout this series, haven't we? We've seen him change and grow. He went from the deceiver, somebody who did sort of manipulate and control to get what he wanted by stealing the birthright and the blessing. But we've seen him grow and change to the point where God even renames him Israel, somebody who contends with God, somebody who prevailed with God. And so is it so hard to think that maybe Jacob bowing down to Esau here was something that was genuine? We also see it in his words as he approaches him. He repeatedly referred to Esau as his Lord and himself as Esau's servants. Look at verse, we're going to jump ahead a little bit here, but verse 5. He lifted up his eyes and saw the women and the children and said, "Who are these with you?" So Jacob said, "The children whom God has graciously given," what? "To your servant." He didn't have to say that. He could have said, "Oh, they're my children. God gave them to me," but he says, "to your servant." Look at verse 8. "What do you mean by all this company which I have met?" And Jacob said, "To find favor in the sight of" what? "My Lord." Jump to verse 13. But he said to him, "My Lord knows that the children are frail." Look at verse 14. "Please let my Lord pass before his servant." Verse 15. Esau said, "Please let me leave with you some of the people who are with me." But Jacob said, "What need is there? Let me find favor in the sight of my Lord." Now this is actually something he did earlier. I won't have you turn there, but in chapter 32, he repeatedly referred to himself as Esau's servant and Esau as his Lord. So we see this pattern emerge. We see him bowing down repeatedly as he approaches, which again, we know in the ancient Near East was a way of paying homage and respect, humility. But he also, in his words, constantly repeats that he was Esau's servant, that Esau was his Lord. The other thing we kind of have to keep in mind is, remember, Esau is the older brother. Now, Jacob had taken the birthright and the blessing. He sort of had usurped that role as the older brother, if you will. But is it so hard to believe that Jacob, in this time that he has come to know the Lord, that he might be reflecting on the fact that Esau is his older brother, that he had harmed Esau by stealing the birthright and the blessing, and as he now approaches his brother, is offering him respect, humility, speaking to him appropriately, that it's not fake? Now, I'm not saying that there's not an element of appeasement here, because he clearly is hoping that Esau is going to receive him with grace. And so he's behaving appropriately. And that's not necessarily wrong, is it? If we wrong somebody and we approach them with humility, and part of our approaching them in humility is that they're going to recognize that we've wronged them and that we're trying to be respectful, is there something wrong with that? I don't believe that there is. And so maybe I'm taking this a little far, but I believe we have to be open to the idea that what's happening here is that Jacob is simply being genuine. And I think we see that in his actions, in his words, that when he approaches Esau, he does so with humility and respect. Now again, not everybody holds that opinion, because they want to see this as a form of manipulation by Jacob, that he's just continuing the same behavior that he's always continued in. But I don't believe that the text bears it out, and we'll see why as we continue through it. So the first thing we see is that as Jacob approaches Esau, he does it with an attitude of humility and respect. The second thing we see is that Esau actually accepts Jacob with grace and affection even. Look at verses 4 through 7. "Then Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. He lifted his eyes and he saw the women and his children, and he said, 'Who are these with you?' So he said, 'The children whom God has graciously given to your servant.' Then the maids came near with their children and they bowed down." Again, respect, humility. Leah likewise came near with her children, and they bowed down. And afterwards, Joseph came near with Rachel, and they bowed down. Again, repeatedly, you see this act of respect. But the focus here actually is going to be on Esau's response. He doesn't wait for Jacob to get to him, does he? Notice it says that he ran. Esau ran to meet Jacob. That should blow our minds, because the last thing we really knew about Esau, or about Esau, was what? He was going to kill him. You might expect him to be rushing at him to kill him now, but instead, he rushes at him, and it says that he embraced him, that he fell on his neck and he kissed him, and they both wept. This was an emotional reunion. You know what it reminds me of? Turn to Luke chapter 15. Luke chapter 15. Luke chapter 15 is where we have a series of parables, one of which is the prodigal son. You remember that? The prodigal son, he runs off, takes his inheritance, wastes it. He's living with the pigs and eating with the pigs, and the only hope he has is to go back to his dad. He's assuming the worst. He's going to go back to serve his dad as a servant, not as a son. But what was his dad's response after being wronged by his son? Jump down to verse 17. Chapter 15, verse 17. But when he came to his senses, he, the son, he said, "How many of my father's hired men have more than enough bread, but I am dying here with hunger? I will get up and go to my father and will say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me as one of your hired men.' So he got up and came to his father. But while he was still a long way off, in the distance, much like Jacob being in the distance from Esau, his father saw him and he felt what? Compassion on him. And he ran and he embraced him and he kissed him. And the son said to the father, 'I have sinned against heaven, and in your sight I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to the slaves, 'Quickly bring out the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and sandals on his feet. And he goes on, you know the rest of that. I believe that as we look at this, that Esau's actions here reflect an attitude of grace, possibly also forgiveness towards his brother. So see, in a moment, there's not so much as a shred of bitterness or resentment on Esau's part towards Jacob at all throughout this passage. We read through it. It doesn't reveal any bitterness, any anger, any resentment. He certainly doesn't want to kill him. In fact, you have the direct opposite: affection, grace, falling on him, weeping. He apparently saw no need for Jacob to make restitution, because we're going to see in a little bit here that he actually rejects Jacob's offer and gift. Is that something somebody does who's resentful or bitter or angry? Or is that something somebody does who's willing to say, "Let bygones be bygones"? He even offered to lead Jacob on his journey home, which is interesting. Just as the father's actions in the parable indicate he forgave his son, I believe Esau's actions suggest that he forgave Jacob and no longer harbored any bitterness, anger, or resentment towards him. Now, I'm not saying that Esau is saved. I think the book of Hebrews makes it pretty clear. He was a godless, immoral man who fell short of the grace of God. But you know what? Even pagans, even unsaved, can sometimes do God-like things, meaning forgive, extend grace, be kind. We see that all the time, don't we? Unsaved people sometimes doing the right thing. So I believe that the actions of Esau here suggest that he was willing to forgive Jacob for his actions before he left Mesopotamia, stealing the birthright and the blessing. What happens next? Jacob actually shares God's blessings with Esau. This is another reason why I don't believe that Jacob's actions here are anything less than genuine. I don't believe that it's just to appease, because at this point, hey, everything's good, right? He doesn't need to take the next step. And that next step is to actually share the blessings of God with his brother Esau. Why would he do that if this were all simply a way to manipulate and control Esau? Because at this point, obviously, Esau's okay. Look at verses 8 through 11. He, meaning Esau, looks at me and says, "What do you mean by all this company which I've met?" In other words, he says, "What's going on here? All these people that have you been sending ahead here, coming in groups, and the animals and everything, you know, what's going on with that?" And Jacob says, "It's to find favor in your sight, my lord." But Esau said, "Oh, I have plenty, my brother. Let what you have be your own." He goes on, he says, Jacob now says, "No, please, if now I have found favor in your sight, then take my present from my hand. For I see your face as one sees the face of God, and you have received me favorably. Please, take my gift, which has been brought to you, because God has dealt graciously with me, and because I have plenty." Thus he urged him, and he, Esau, took it. We know from earlier in chapter 2 that Jacob sent the gifts, at least in part, to soften Esau's heart, to earn his favor, and that's pretty much confirmed here. He says, "I did it to find favor," verse 19 and 20. "I did it to find favor." I'm sorry, he said that in chapter 32. But then he repeats it here in verse 8. To find favor, to find grace in your sight. That's why I did it. You notice that, again, some believe Jacob's actions here was a form of just manipulation, but there are others, and I would fall in line with them, that believe that what Jacob has in mind here is a form of restitution for stealing the birthright and the blessing. And again, I'll say that this is a bit speculative, but I believe there's merit to it. Esau had become wealthy and prosperous all on his own. So verse 9 tells us that he rejected the gift. "I don't need it." But it's Jacob's response that makes me consider the fact that this may have been a way of restitution or a way of sharing God's blessings with him. Esau had received him with favor, just as Jacob had wanted. It could have ended right there. Mission accomplished. Everything I've done up until this point, just showing that I'm willing to give him some gifts, has accomplished its purpose, right? Esau is appeased. He's accepted me with grace and favor. He's wept over me. So we're all good. We go on our happy way, right? So when Esau rejects that gift, what does Jacob actually do? He presses on. He insists. But he doesn't just insist. I want to focus on some words here. In verse 11, we read this: "Please take my gift which has been brought to you, because God has dealt graciously with me, and because I have plenty." Now here's what's interesting about this. The word translated gift or present in verse 11 is different than the words that are translated gift and present earlier in this chapter, in the previous one. In other words, he uses a different word. Originally, it was the word gift or present. Here, it's actually the word for blessing. Why is that important? A more appropriate way, I'm going to say, of rendering this is, "Please take my blessing. Please take my blessing, which has been brought to you, because God has dealt graciously with me, and because I have plenty." Now, I think that's important because back in chapter 27, verse 36, you look at the words that Esau used, chapter 27, verse 36. He's complaining to Isaac, his father, about Jacob, and he says in verse 36, "Is he not rightly named Jacob? For he has supplanted me these two times. He took away my birthright, and behold, now he has taken away my blessing, same word that Jacob uses. In essence, what Jacob is doing here is he's not just offering a gift of his to Esau, but he's taking part of the blessing that the Lord had given to him, and he's telling Esau, now take my blessing as your own. He's sharing God's blessings with him, which I believe is a form of restitution. Again, I'm going out on a limb here. The text doesn't tell us this is restitution, but Jacob didn't need to do this. Again, Esau's appeased. We're good to go. But he insists, God has blessed me, and Esau, I know you have more than enough. But you know what? I'm giving you part of the blessing that the Father has given to me. Maybe, possibly, one of the reasons is Jacob has come to the point where he's realized and recognized, I have stolen Esau's blessing as the older son. I am now returning part of that blessing because the Lord has blessed me. I'm now giving a portion of that to you. Again, speculative, but to me that's a better answer to what's happening than Jacob's just trying to manipulate Esau. And those that are of that opinion will look at this and say, well, yeah, but even though Esau had rejected it, Jacob still feels the need to do that because he doesn't trust Esau. Well, that's reading into the text too. It's coming up with something that really isn't revealed in the text. But because of this perspective that Jacob is still the deceiver and still the manipulator here, that has to be his motives. I don't believe that's the case. Everything we see in this passage seems to suggest something else. Jacob approaching him with this attitude of respect, this attitude of humility, sharing God's blessings with him, not just as a gift, but as part of the blessings. And so Jacob shares his blessings with Esau. He says, I have plenty. So he urged him, it says in verse 11. And as a result, then Esau takes it. Doesn't need it, but took it, being offered by his brother. So again, the text doesn't specifically or explicitly state that this was a form of restitution or a form of sharing blessings. I believe that's what's happening here. The last thing we see is Jacob and Esau parting in peace. There's one more small section we're going to use to take away, but the fourth part of our breakdown here is that after this all sort of finishes, Jacob and Esau part in peace, which comes as a welcome to us because they didn't separate in peace, but now they separate in peace. In other words, when Jacob left Mesopotamia, there was no peace. But now this time as they separate, they do so in peace. Look at verses 12 through 17. Esau said, let us take our journey and go, and I will go before you. But he said to him, my Lord knows that the children are frail, and the flocks and the herds which are nursing are a care to me. And if they are driven hard one day, all the flocks will die. Please let my Lord pass on before his servant, and I will proceed at my leisure according to the pace of the cattle which are before, and according to the pace of the children, until I come to my Lord at Seir. Esau said, please let me leave with you some of the people who are with me. But he said, what need is there? Let me find favor in the sight of my Lord. So Esau returned that day on his way to Seir. Last verse there, verse 17, Jacob journeyed to Succoth and built for himself a house and made booths for his livestock. Therefore the place is named Succoth. We see two more acts of grace, I believe, on the part of Esau here. The first is that he offers to not only accompany Jacob back, but you notice that he says, go before. This phrase is often used in the Old Testament to describe protection. And that's likely what is intended here. This may explain why Esau came out with 400 men. His intent appears to have been to meet Jacob along the journey and then to go before him and lead him back to his home, and the 400 men were likely fighting men, servants. We oftentimes forget about the dangers that they faced when traveling out in the wilderness like this. And so I believe this is an act of grace. He offers to go before him, to protect him. We will lead you back home. The second act of grace also relates to protection, because when Jacob refuses, when he says no, Esau says, well, at least let me leave some men with you. Again, what would the purpose of that be? Now, this again is where I diverge from some individuals, because again, a common approach to this is that, you see what's going on here? Jacob still doesn't trust Esau. He's not willing to now follow Esau, so he comes up with an excuse. He says, well, you know, the kids are tired, the animals are tired. If I move on from here now, we're all going to die. And so he's again deceiving and manipulating Esau. But think about this for a moment. They had traveled over 450 miles so far in the wilderness. They've got at least another 100 miles to go before they get home. Is it so unreasonable to believe that Jacob is exhausted? They've traveled a long distance with a large family, with tons of animals. I mean, he's already given 500 plus, and that was just a small portion of what he had. And so they're moving through. Not only that, but he's been afraid. He wrestled with the Lord out in the wilderness the night before. Is it possible that Jacob is just exhausted? That his family's exhausted? And he genuinely is concerned that if I continue driving them right now, they're going to suffer. So, we'll come, we'll follow you. And there's no need for you to protect us. We'll follow you on to Seir. We'll come as the Lord ultimately leads. Again, be careful here, but I favor the second option, which is that he was simply being genuine here. I'm not going to allow this, I'm going to call it generic idea that Jacob was always the deceiver and never grew out of that. I'm not going to allow that to color what we see here, but just take it at face value. And the same individuals oftentimes will say, well, we have proof of him being a deceiver still because he tells Esau that he'll go ahead and he'll join him at Seir, but he never does. Instead, he goes to Succoth. And then he never gets to Seir. Well, you know, an obvious answer to that is he may very well have intended to follow him. He does what he says here. He needs to rest, so he goes to Succoth and he rests there. But what's interesting is later in chapter 35, verse 1, God tells him where to go, and it isn't to Seir. So again, is it possible that Jacob fully intends, I will follow you down to Seir? It'll come later. And that was his intent. But God's intent is, no, I don't want you going to Seir, I want you going home. And so God tells him in verse 1 of chapter 35 to go home, and that's what he does. Again, I find that a more acceptable answer to this. But what we see here is that ultimately, they separate in peace. Because Esau goes back to Seir, and Jacob ultimately ends up going to Succoth. He gets sidetracked a little bit later. Doesn't quite move on. In fact, he's there for quite a few years. And he ultimately doesn't make it to Seir. But what's also interesting about this is later we learn that Esau apparently returned home, not to Seir, went to Seir first, but then he ultimately goes back home to Jacob. And part of the reason we know that is because we're told in Genesis 36 that Esau had to leave and go back to Seir because his flocks and Jacob's flocks had grown too much for the land to sustain both of them. So after Isaac dies, they separate again. What that tells us is that even though at this point they separate and Esau goes to Seir and Jacob ultimately will go back home, it tells us that Esau probably went back home as well at some point and lived side by side with Jacob until they got to the point where the land could not sustain both of their flocks. And at that point, Esau then goes back to Seir and Jacob stays home. Which again suggests that they're at peace, that there's no more warring, if you will, between them. And so again, Jacob and Esau ultimately part in peace. Now, let's look at verses 18 through 20, and we're going to take our takeaways from all of that as we wrap it up with these last few verses here. Verses 18 through 20. So after Esau leaves, it says, Jacob now came safely to the city of Shechem. So he went to Succoth first for a short period of time. Then he moves on to Shechem, which is on the journey back home down to where his father and family was. It says, which is in the land of Canaan. When he came from Padam Aram, and he camped before the city, he bought a piece of land where he had pitched his tent from the hand of the sons of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money. Then he erected there an altar and called it El Elohe Israel. So what do we see here? He basically goes to Shechem. We're going to find that he gets stuck at Shechem for quite some time. But it's interesting here. If we think about what's ultimately happened, he's now in the land of Canaan, it says in verse 18. It says that he returns to Shechem, or goes to Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan. Now, why is that important? Well, one of the takeaways, I think, that we should grab from this is ultimately Jacob's conflict is resolved with Esau, primarily because God has brought him back. And so, when we look at all of this, we have to ask, okay, we see these two brothers who are warring. One has to run because he's being threatened by the other one. God ultimately brings the two of them back together, and we see this forgiveness, we see this grace. One of the takeaways for us is we can look at that and say, well, isn't this exactly what the Scriptures call us to do when faced with conflict or hurting one another or sinning against one another? We have Jacob who approaches Esau with humility, possibly with restitution. Regardless of how we view what happened with the birthright and the blessing, clearly that was God's intent, that Jacob would receive the birthright and the blessing. But how he went about doing it wasn't necessarily righteous. And in that respect, he had wronged Esau, taking what wasn't rightfully earthly his, but he manipulated, he lied, he deceived. So he approaches Esau with humility and restitution. Isn't that how we're supposed to behave as Christians? Esau, what does he do? As he's approached, offers grace and forgiveness. Is that also not a good example for us? When somebody has wronged us and they come to us, the Bible tells us we're to what? Forgive. And how many times? You know the story. 70 times 7. So that's, I think, a fair takeaway for us, is to see within these things proper Christ-like behavior. And again, that doesn't say that Esau is saved, because even unsaved people sometimes do the right thing. Okay? But I think there's an even bigger overarching takeaway from not just this passage, but what we've seen up until this point. And it's pretty much this, that both God and Jacob fulfilled their promises to one another. Because the reason that Jacob is now here is because of something God had promised to him. And God made good on that promise. Go back to Genesis chapter 28. Genesis chapter 28, verses 10 through 15. It says that Jacob departed from Beersheba, and he went to a place called Haran. He came to a certain place and spent the night there because the sun had set, and he took one of the stones of the place and put it under his head, and he lay down in that place. He had a dream, and behold, a ladder was set on earth, and its top was reaching into the heaven, and behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it, and he said, I'm the Lord, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give it to you as your descendants, and to your descendants. Your descendants will also be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the west and the east and the north and the south, and in you all the descendants and all the families of the earth will be blessed. Behold, I am with you. I will keep you wherever you go. And then look at this. I will bring you back to this land. What's the land he's talking about there? He's talking about Canaan. So the Lord said, I will bring you back to Canaan. And then says, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. And what does it tell us? Keep your finger there. But what does it tell us back in chapter 33? It says that he is now back in Shechem in the land of Canaan. God has made good, at least in part, on his promises. Because there's additional promises God has made. But this is one of them. And this is where it begins. God intended to bless Jacob in Canaan. And so he had brought him back to Canaan exactly as he had promised he would. But we also see in these last few verses here that I believe Jacob makes good on his promise or his vow to the Lord as well. Go back to chapter 28. Looked out at verses 18 through, I think it's 18 through 20 or so. Jacob rose early in the morning and he took the stone that had been under his head and he set it up as a pillar and poured oil on its top. He called the name of that place Bethel. However, previously the name of the city was Luz. Then Jacob made a vow, made a promise, saying, if God will be with me and will keep me on this journey that I take and will give me food to eat and garments to wear, and I, as we worked through this, I suggested a different rendering of this, and will return me to my father's house in safety, then the Lord, what? Will be my God. The stone which I have set up as a pillar will be God's house. And of all that you gave me, I will surely give you a tenth. So what's Jacob's vow? What's his promise? He promised, God will be my God. Now, jump back into chapter 33 and look at the very last verse, verse 20. Notice what it says there? Then he erected there an altar and he called it El Elohe Israel. It means God, the God of Israel. Now, when you first read that, you might think that's true. God is the God of Israel. But Israel there is not the country Israel. It's not the nation Israel. Who is Israel there? It's Jacob. What is Jacob saying? God is my God. He is the God of Israel. Isn't that what he said back in chapter 28? Isn't that the vow that he made to God? If you take me back to the land, God will be my God. So he sets up a pillar and he says, God, the God of Israel. That's remarkable. Now, again, I would say that this is a partial fulfillment. We're going to find out, this is a bit of a teaser here, but we're going to find out that, I think it's next week, Jacob goes on to Shechem, but he gets stuck there for a while. And God lets him stick there for a little bit and finally gives him a kick in the pants and says, I told you, go on! And so God's going to have to push him a little bit to fulfill the rest of the journey and finally go completely home. But it all begins here. He's back in the land. God had fulfilled his promise to Jacob. And Jacob fulfilled his vow or promise to the Lord and declared, God is the God of Israel. So what does that mean for us? If I think about this, it should encourage us to trust the Lord with his promises to us, should it not? This is the pattern we see throughout the scriptures. God is always a God that makes good on his promises. If he says he's going to do it, he does it. And yet we still struggle, don't we? The Bible's filled with something like 8,000 promises, and half the time we're like, oh, really? You know, maybe. But God is a God who can be trusted. Even when Jacob was struggling with Laban and being chased down and going through the wilderness and then being confronted with Esau, and all, he had to learn, I got to trust the Lord. And the Lord made good on his promise. It's the same with us. Especially including his promise of his return. Isn't that what we're ultimately waiting for? The Bible reminds us continually we ought to be anticipating, waiting for Christ to return and take us home in much the same way that God took Jacob home. That's what we're waiting for. We kind of like hanging out here, don't we? But really, we're all supposed to be anticipating Christ's return, that glorious promise, our blessed hope that he might take us home. Should also motivate us to keep our end of the deal, if you will. When we commit our lives to Christ, it's a promise, is it not? It is a promise that I will be yours, I will serve you, you will be my God. And yet the scriptures are filled with encouragement to endure to the very end. To the point at which he takes us home, or that he returns and takes us to our heavenly home. So just as Jacob fulfilled his vow, we should as well. Unfortunately, some don't. Some profess in word only. Some act like they're saved until things get tough. They abandon the faith. We can argue about loss of salvation, etc. But the reality of it is, some do not endure. Some do not make good on that promise. And yet we are called to. Are we not? So, as I look at this, I think those are the greater takeaways. That God always makes good on His promise. It ought to motivate us to trust Him to make good on the promises that He's made to us. Not just the little ones, the everyday ones, but the ultimate one of coming back. In Peter's day, they struggled and they said, "Where is He?" You know, they were only struggling with 30 or 40 years. "Where is He? He hasn't come back. Everything's the same." Here we are 2,000 years later and some of us are going, "Where is He? Nothing has changed." He will come back. We can trust Him on that. But in the meantime, we fulfill our vow to remain faithful. Make Him our God. Amen?